In some watertight compartment, the brightness told me I had to accept that I would not survive that moment. I wanted to live, I really did, but I couldn't any longer. I couldn't even breathe any longer. So I opened my mouth and welcomed the water, welcomed the torrent, except it wasn't really water. And the eyes upon me were not eyes. And I was pinned there now by the crawler, had let it in, I realized, so that its full regard was upon me, and I could not move, could not think, was helpless and alone. A raging waterfall crashed down on my mind, but the water was comprised of fingers, 100 fingers, probing and pressing down into the skin of my neck, and then punching up through the bone of the back of my skull and into my brain. And then the pressure eased, even though the impression of unlimited force did not let up, and for a time, still drowning, an icy calm came over me, and through the calm bled a kind of monumental blue-green light. I smelled a burning inside my own head, and there came a moment when I screamed, my skull crushed to dust, and reassembled mote by mote. There shall be a fire that knows your name, and in the presence of the strangling fruit, its dark flame shall acquire every part of you. It was the most agony I have ever been in, as if a metal rod had been repeatedly thrust into me, and then the pain distributed like a second skin inside the contours of my outline. Everything became tinged with the red. I blacked out. I came to, I blacked out, came to, blacked out, still perpetually gasping for breath, knees buckling, scrabbling at the wall for support. My mouth opened so wide from the shrieking that something popped in my jaw. I think I stopped breathing for a minute, but the brightness inside experienced no such interruption. It just kept oxygenating my blood. Then the terrible invasiveness was gone. Ripped away, and with it the sensation of drowning and the thick sea that had surrounded me. There came a push, and the crawler tossed me aside, down the steps beyond it. I washed up there, bruised and crumpled. With nothing to lean against, I fell like a sack, crumpling before something that was never meant to be, something never meant to invade me. I sucked in air in great shuddering gasps. But I couldn't stay there, still within the range of its regard. I had no choice now. Throat raw, my insides feeling eviscerated, I flung myself down into the greater dark below the crawler, on my hands and knees at first, scrabbling to escape, taken over by a blind, panicked impulse to get out of the sight of it. Only when the light behind me had faded, only when I felt safe did I drop to the floor again. I lay there for a long time. Apparently, I was recognizable to the crawler now. Apparently, I was words it could understand, unlike the anthropologist. I wondered if my cells would long be able to hide their transformation from me. I wondered if this was the beginning of the end. But mostly, I felt the utter relief of having passed a gauntlet, if barely. The brightness deep within was curled up, traumatized. Perhaps my only real expertise, my only talent, is to endure beyond the endurable. I don't know when I managed to stand again, to continue on, legs rubbery. I don't know how long that took. But eventually I got up. Soon the spiral stairs straightened out, and with this straightening, the stifling humidity abruptly lessened, and the tiny creatures that lived on the wall were no longer to be seen, and the sounds from the crawler above took on a more muffled texture. Though I still saw the ghosts of past scrawlings on the wall, even my own luminescence became muted here. I was wary of that tracery of words, as if somehow they could hurt me as surely as the crawler, and yet there was some comfort in following them. Here the variations were more legible, and now made more sense to me. And it came for me, and it cast out all else. Retraced again and again, were the words more naked down here, or did I just possess more knowledge now? I couldn't help but notice that these new steps shared the depth and width of the lighthouse steps almost exactly. Above me, the unbroken surface of the ceiling had changed so that now a profusion of deep, curving grooves crisscrossed it. I stopped to drink water. I stopped to catch my breath. The aftershock of the encounter with the crawler was still washing over me in waves. When I continued, it was with a kind of numbed awareness that there might be more revelations still to absorb, that I had to prepare myself, somehow. A few minutes later, a tiny rectangular block of fuzzy white light began to take form, shape, far below. As I descended, it became larger with a reluctance I can only call hesitation. After another half hour, I thought it must be a kind of door, but the haziness remained, almost as if it were obscuring itself. The closer I got, and with it still distant, the more I was also certain that this door bore an uncanny resemblance to the door I had seen in my glance back, after having crossed the border on our way to base camp. The very vagueness of it triggered this response, because it was a specific kind of vagueness. In the next half hour after that, I began to feel an instinctual urge to turn back, which I overrode by telling myself I could not yet face the return journey and the crawler again. But the grooves in the ceiling hurt to look at, as if they ran across the outside of my own skull, continually being remade there. They had become lines of some repelling force. An hour later, as that shimmering white rectangle became larger but no more distinct, I was filled with such a feeling of wrongness that I suffered nausea. The idea of a trap grew in my mind, that this floating light in the darkness was not a door at all, but the maw of some beast, and if I entered through it to the other side, it would devour me. Finally I came to a halt. The words continued, unrelenting, downward, and I estimated the door lay no more than another 500 or 600 steps below me. It blazed in my vision now. I could feel a rawness to my skin, as if I were getting a sunburn from looking at it. I wanted to continue on, but I could not continue on. I could not will my legs to do it, could not force my mind to overcome the fear and uneasiness. Even the temporary absence of the brightness, as if hiding, counseled against further progress. I remained there, sitting on the steps, watching the door, for some time. I worried that this sensation was residual hypnotic compulsion, that even from beyond death the psychologist had found a way to manipulate me. Perhaps there had been some encoded order or directive my infection had not been able to circumvent or override. Was I in the end stages of some prolonged form of annihilation? The reason didn't matter, though. I knew I would never reach the door. I would become so sick I wouldn't be able to move, and I would never make it back to the surface, eyes cut and blinded by the grooves in the ceiling. I would be stuck on the steps, just like the anthropologist, and almost as much of a failure as she and the psychologist had been in recognizing the impossible. So I turned around, and, in a great deal of pain, feeling as if I had left part of myself there, I began to trudge back up those steps, the image of a hazy door of light as large in my imagination as the immensity of the crawler. I remember the sensation, in that moment of turning away, that something was now peering out at me from the door below. But when I glanced over my shoulder, only the familiar hazy white brilliance greeted me. I wish I could say that the rest of the journey was a blur, as if I were indeed the flame the psychologist had seen, and I was staring out through my own burning. I wish that what came next was sunlight and the surface, but although I had earned the right for it to be over, it was not over. I remember every painful, scary step back up, every moment of it. I remember halting before I turned the corner, where again lay the crawler, still busy and incomprehensible in its task, unsure if I could endure the excavation of my mind once more, unsure if I would go mad from the sensation of drowning this time, no matter how much reason told me it was an illusion. But also knowing that the weaker I became, the more my mind would betray me. Soon it would be easy to retreat into the shadows, to become some shell haunting the lower steps. I might never have more strength or resolve to summon than in that moment. I let go of Rock Bay, of the starfish in its pool. I thought instead of my husband's journal. I thought about my husband in a boat somewhere to the north. I thought about how everything lay above and nothing now below. So I hugged the wall again. So I closed my eyes again. So I endured the light again and flinched and moaned, expecting the rush of the sea into my mouth and my head cracked open. But none of that happened. None of it. And I don't know why, except that having scanned and sampled me and having, based on some unknown criteria, released me once, the crawler no longer displayed any interest in me. I was almost out of sight above it, rounding the corner, when some stubborn part of me insisted on risking a single glance back, one last ill-advised, defiant glance at something I might never understand. Staring back at me amid that profusion of selves generated by the crawler, I saw, barely visible, the face of a man, hooded in shadow and orbited by indescribable things I could think of only as his jailers. The man's expression displayed such a complex and naked extremity of emotion that it transfixed me. I saw on those features the endurance of an unending pain and sorrow, yes, but shining through as well a kind of grim satisfaction and ecstasy. I had never seen such an expression before, but I recognized that face. I had seen it in a photograph. A sharp eagle's eye gleamed out from a heavy face, the left eye lost to his squint. A thick beard hid all but a hint of a firm chin under it. Trapped within the crawler, the last lighthouse keeper stared out at me, or it seemed, not just across a vast, unbridgeable gulf, but also out across the years. For though thinner, his eyes receded in their orbits, his jawline more pronounced, the lighthouse keeper had not aged a day since that photograph was taken more than 30 years ago. This man, who now existed in a place none of us could comprehend. Did he know what he had become, or had he gone mad long ago? Could he even really see me? I do not know how long he had been looking at me, observing me, before I had turned to see him, or if he had even existed before I saw him, but he was real to me, even though I held his gaze for such a short time, too short a time, and I cannot say anything passed between us. How long would have been enough? There was nothing I could do for him, and had no room left in me for anything but my own survival. There might be far worse things than drowning. I could not tell what he had lost or what he might have gained over the past 30 years, but I envied him that journey not at all. I never dreamed before Area X, or at least I never remembered my dreams. My husband found this strange and told me once that maybe this meant I lived in a continuous dream from which I had never woken up. Perhaps he meant it as a joke. Perhaps not. He had, after all, been haunted by a nightmare for years, had been shaped by it, until it had all fallen away from him, revealed as a facade, a house and a basement and the awful crimes that had occurred there. But I'd had an exhausting day at work and took it seriously, especially because it was the last week before he left on the expedition.